Hello. We've moved to Bristol. We're in Bristol now. And it's the fall of 1924. Now, why are we in Bristol? Dad lost his job in Winsted, and he kept looking for another job. And we were financially pretty poor shape in those days. At times, there wasn't any money at all in the house in Winsted. And I remember the time in particular when my sister had a terrible toothache, and we always used to take raisins and chew on them and get a big wad of them and put up against the tooth that was aching, you know. And Dad was off looking for a job in Bristol, I guess, Mildred had this awful toothache. We didn't have enough money in the house to get a box of raisins. And I suddenly remembered down at the fruit store they had these little small boxes of raisins which we could get for a small amount. I think Mother had 14 cents or something. But we were able to get this little box of raisins to help on the toothache problem. But we were pretty poor family in those, and Dad heroically went from place to place looking for more work. And he had taken the jitney to Hartford. They didn't have buses, they called them jitneys in those days. And then another one to Bristol, and in the new departure company he landed a new job. That was so fortunate for Dad and for the rest of the family, because Dad worked in the new departure company for the rest of his working days. He finally retired very, very late in his life. But anyway, we moved into Bristol, and we moved into Bristol in a nice new house, fairly new, on a large project where they built 101 houses, something or other like that, tremendous number of them, and a good lot of them were empty because they were trying to entice people down from Canada. They had advertisements in Montreal and other Quebec and other French locations, and they were able to get a lot of French people down to work here in New Departure. And of course there was a lot of jobs for some reason in 1924, and we were very happy that Dad got his job. Dad was a specialist in repairing and installing the belts, the big wide 6 or 8 inch belts that they used on the in the factories, on the machinery in those days. Most of the machines were driven from overhead pulleys and shafts, and they were run with these great big belts, and Dad was an expert at repairing them, fixing the ones that were broken and splicing them and so forth. And he had great skill in that, and he kept his job for a long time. Anyway, back to Bristol. We moved into 17 Cypress Street in Bristol, and we were there all that winter, and it was a tough winter, and it was cold and wet feet, and we slid on the street, of course, with my red sled, of course, and we got sick, and I can remember being sick with some flu or pneumonia or something, and being delirious, being out of my head, and suddenly remembering lying there and waking up and my mother saying, he came out of it, or something or other like that. It was a bad winter. And I don't remember too much of that winter, but in the spring I remember going fishing for the first time, trout fishing up on one of the local brooks. And I remember my friend, two doors up the house, there was an Indian family. And when I mean Indian, they were American Indians. They were from Maine, came to go work in New Departure, I guess. And they were Penobscot Indian tribe. We knew two of the boys there, and their last name was Shea, S-H-A-Y, and they had named the boys. One boy was Winter Shea, and the other one was Summer Shay. One day, playing in the yard there, when the ambulance came up and pulled over and at the Shay's house, and they wheeled out Winter Shay. Winter Shay was dying. He had appendicitis, and it had burst, and they took him out. That was the first time I'd seen an ambulance, I guess.
I just found out. I'm wrong. That wasn't 1924. That was the fall of 1922 when we first moved to Bristol.
By the next spring, my folks decided to get out of that 17 Cypress Street because the kitchen door faced to the north, and it was just an ordinary plain door, and the rain and the frost and everything piled right into the kitchen. It was a terrible place. And when it was a heavy rain, the cellar filled with water. It was just a dirt floor and filled with water. So they took over a different rent, same outfit, the same development, one street farther south, and that was Beach Street. And we lived on Beach Street for a number of years. That first place was at number 10 Beach Street. This was the second floor. And we had two bedrooms and another and an attic room up in the attic. The upstairs rent there also had the attic with a stairway going up so you could sleep people up there also. And in the downstairs there was a family called the Henrys. There was Robert Henry was about a year or so younger than I, and he had an older brother, and I've forgotten his name. And Mrs. Henry played the piano. She played it loud and heavy. And I remember her singing and playing, "Oh, Katerina, you should be leaner." That was one of them. And Mr. Henry, he had a different occupation for his hobby. He was trying to become a hypnotist. And with kids, we used to peek in the windows and watch Mr. Henry, and he would have somebody in there who was trying to hypnotize with a rope on the floor, and he was saying, "You can't cross over that, you can't cross over that line, you can't cross over that line." I don't know if they ever did or not, but that was a lot of fun. Well, I don't know. We were in the sixth grade, you know, when we moved in there that first winter, and Mildred was in seventh grade, and it was at the beautiful, beautiful new school, the John J. Jennings School. The money for the school was left by this Mr. John J. Jennings, I assume, anyway. And it was a most beautiful studio, most beautiful place. It was the only school in old town of Bristol that had its own gymnasium. The gymnasium was in the basement. In fact, it was half of a floor below the basement. And it was all the equipment and ropes to pile to climb up. And there were these horses that the gymnasts use, you know, and a springboard. You jumped on them and jumped over the horses. And we used to, of course, once a week, the physical director from the city of Bristol came up there and showed us how to do all these different things on the apparatus. It was a wonderful place. And we could play basketball. All our spare time, the boys would go down there, and, you know, there were five basketball teams amongst the sixth, seventh, and eighth grade boys. And I think I was on the fifth team. I never saw basketball played before. And I can remember the first time somebody threw the ball to me, I start running across the floor to throw it in the basket without knowing that I have to bounce it on the way. Those were good old days, you know. They were good old days, and that But I made a mistake back there. It was not 1924 that we moved to Bristol. That was 1922. I was in the sixth grade. In 23, I was in the seventh grade there at John Jennings School. And it was in the, let's see, 1924, I was in the seventh grade. And in 1925, I was in the eighth grade, and I graduated from that school in 1925. I'm going to try to get these events in the proper chronological order, but things are kind of hazy, you know, and up here in my head, and they kind of merge together at times, and I forget what year was what. Anyway, let me first tell you about, I'm sure it was 1923, the first time we saw the ice house work. We know right near our house was this nice, beautiful pond, Burgess Pond. Oh, it's probably about 10, 12 acres or so. Many, many, many times, happy times we're going to be having in it, fishing and swimming and so forth in later years. But 1923, the first time we saw the ice house operate in its proper function, it was a cold winter and they had this beautiful frozen pond, the ice, no snow on it, absolutely clear. When they started marking it first, they had a machine, gasoline driven, that moved across the ice and had a big saw, rotary saw out in the front, and it went down the pond and back the pond and realized what they were doing. They were cutting, they were marking big squares, just like a, oh heavens, just like a crossword puzzle squares on the ice, just marks. And afterwards, they came with, I think, the same saw, and they cut, instead of just marking the top, they cut all the way down through the complete thickness of the ice, which was probably 10 inches or so, maybe a foot, and they'd go and they'd cut way down one long line, and maybe 8 or 10 different of these squares, and then it would cut it off, and it would float. It would float by itself, and of course they had broken, and so they had open water there to float them on, and they would float these long, they were 10, 12, 15 foot long. It was like a long raft, and floated down to where they had the input to the ramp. I guess it was a ramp. Yeah, it was a chute, like where they brought the ice up into the ice house. And just as they got down there, it was this long strip. There was a man that was standing there with a big chisel, and as it came to him, he hit it once, and it plop off one piece. And it was one big ice cube, and that went into the mechanism, the chute, and that brought them. It had a bar behind it, and it pushed it up a long slide up into the ice house. And of course, this was driven by a machine. It had to be have some power source, and the power source was a gas engine. In those days, the gas engines were quite elementary, you know, and this one was a single cylinder, one cylinder, like they used to use for sawing wood in the woods. It would go plunk, 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 bang, 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 like that. And you, maybe you older folks remember some of those. It powered the chain and arrangement that hauled the things up into the ice house. Well, they started at the ground floor at the ice house, and then after they got that number of layers of ice in there, they would have to go up to another area. So they changed some blocks and things so that the chute went up to the second level and so forth all the way up till at the end of the season they get the whole ice house full. And well, they'd put one layer of ice in and then they'd put sawdust on it and then another layer of ice and then they put sawdust on it. So usually sometimes they'd have 10, 15 layers of it all the way up through the summer. That sawdust and all would keep the ice until all summer long. They'd keep hauling that that ice out use in the ice boxes that we had. Everybody had ice boxes to keep their food cool. There were no electric refrigerators like you kids have today, you know. Anyway, that was the fun. What do I remember also about that ice harvesting particular? I remember one time watching when there came several wild deer, with their horns sticking. They were the male deer, buck deer you call them, I guess, and were being chased by several dogs, and they came out of the woods, and the deer are running, and across the ice, and the dogs are chasing them. Oh, the deer ran all the way down to the big open space where they'd been harvesting the ice. It was open water. And they got to the end of us, and they jumped with a beautiful big jump across the open water and landed on the ice on the other side and got away. And the dogs ended up at the same spot, and they couldn't jump that far. And they were frustrated. That actually happened, you know. I'm not making that story up at all. Now, we come to the spring, I guess, of 1924, and I really got interested in baseball. All the boys in school had a baseball glove, and we played, and the big sport was knocking out flies in the afternoon and before school and at recess time and every available time. Sometimes we just caught from one to the other. I was able to obtain an old baseball glove from some source that I've forgotten, and I'm starting to learn how to catch and how to throw and so forth. And baseball was a great new thing for me to do. And also that 1924 early spring and early summer before school, I joined the Boy Scouts of America. And that was a most wonderful thing. I was just so happy with it. I just loved it. I ate it all up. I joined Troop 12 Bristol. I got in Bristol, and it was sponsored by the Knights of Columbus. I had a wonderful scoutmaster named Tom Rogan, and Tom Rogan had one bad eye, and when he looked at you, you didn't know if he was looking at you or looking at the guy next door. It was the funniest thing. Oh, we loved him, though, and he loved Boy Scouting. And many, many years later, when I had been a scoutmaster myself and came up to a get-together meeting, when he saw me, he cried. Because he remembers I was one of his very special Boy Scouts. That first fall, I remember my first hike we went on, a daytime hike. It was up into some ledges in the Federal Hill section of Bristol, Copper Ledges area, somewhere up in there. And we cooked our own, we cooked, baked some potatoes in the coals, and everybody had it, brought a small piece of steak, and we had them on a forked stick, and we broiled them over the fire, and had a great time eating it up and walking home again. And there was probably 10 or 15 Boy Scouts. I was not in uniform. Later on, my folks were able to buy one piece of a uniform for me, just the shirt, and then later I got a pair of official Boy Scout trousers, and I was really well into scouting. We all wore neckerchiefs, you know, and a slide, and we learned to signal with the semaphore flags. Mike Churchill and I were a semaphore team in the various contests that we had in Bristol between the number of different troops. There were up to 9, 10, 11 different troops sponsored by different groups, different churches, Knights of Columbus and the American Legion, various units. They all sponsored Boy Scout troops. And these contests we had every month or so where everybody competed with the other troop in signaling and first aid contests and different skills, Boy Scout skills. It was great. We were learning. And it was a thing that had a great influence on my life then and a great influence in my future life. My friend Mike Churchill kept in touch with me over the years. And we still talk to each other every week on the ham radio. He and I became great friends, have stayed great friends. He'd been a great radio operator on shipboard. He operated for the United Fruit Company. He became plant superintendent of a huge new electrical factory in Bristol. And to this day, Mike Churchill and I are great friends. My old signaling companion. Well, I should get into some other activities that were so important to us young people in those days. And one thing that we looked forward to for months and months was our celebration on the 4th of July, the fireworks. We saved our money, our pennies, everything we could earn to buy fireworks, to buy salutes, to buy Japanese big group of fireworks. And it was a great great fun watching for it, waiting for it, and all day long the day by the time the end of the day comes, we'd watch the salutes and the skyrockets and Roman candles and all the other things that the kids had when it got dark. It was a great sport. But it was dangerous, you know. It was very dangerous to be playing with those things. In fact, one day, there at 10 Beach Street, I remember we were on the upstairs porch when I accidentally set off a 5-inch salute in my hand. My sister had set off a salute in her hand, and I'm watching her and did not pay attention till at the match I was using, and mine went off. So both of us had one explode in our hands. Fortunately, we weren't hurt badly, just blackened fingers and sore, and our eyes are still good. Well, at least mine are. My sister's are getting bad. We soon found out, though, in subsequent years, that it was we could get much more of a bang for our dollar or for our pennies in those days. If we didn't buy those salutes and things, we used to buy blank cartridges, and they had blank pistols in those days that were arranged so you could not put a regular bullet in it. It wouldn't, but you could put a blank cartridge in it, and to buy a box of 50 blank cartridges was much more economical. You could get more bangs for the dollar, and we changed. Some of us older boys, I was getting probably 10, 11 years old by then, and so that was 4th of July in the old days. You kids, you're never going to have that little fun that we had. Before I get too far, I should explain about our first experiences with radio. And I'm not sure if it was 1923, fall and winter, or just when there. I guess it was. My dad had obtained a tube receiver. It had a one tube detector and a two tube audio stage with it. I remember it very well. And we used to sit in the evening, all around, several of us, two, three of us, listening on the earphones. And we had two pairs of earphones, but sometimes there was more than two people. We'd detach one earphone and hand the other one to the other person so we could get four of us each listening with one earphone. But Dad was able to pick up very far DX stations. He would get stations from Miami, W1IOD, Isle of Dreams. Wonderful Isle of Dreams, they said. And in Chicago, there was WLS. There was World's Largest Store, they called it. And KFI in California, and KPOX. In California, I don't know what that. KMOX was in St. Louis. I know we had all these WLW in Cincinnati, a lot of these old DX stations, and what a thrill that was! And of course, far different than it was today. Of course, the radio operated with a storage battery, a 6-volt storage battery operated, lit the filaments in the tubes. Only tubes, you know, in those days, no transistors. And it had B batteries to use for the plate supply, for the plates. Well, though, of course, that storage battery would lose its power after a while. It would be getting down, and it would have to be recharged. And that was quite an expensive thing, but Dad could get them recharged over in his factory, because at the factory, they had a big battery room there, and we could get them charged easily. Of course, these batteries are pretty heavy. You know, if you've ever taken one out of a car, they're pretty heavy. Well, Dad used to get it over to the factory over at the Ford shop in Bristol, and could get it charged, and it was a job getting it home. But it happened that sometimes I would be able to help by meeting him over there with my sled on snow in the winter time, and we'd get the battery down onto the sled and tie it down and so forth, and get it back that way. That was fine. Only night, I remember, I was supposed to meet him at 5 o'clock, or no, 6 o'clock. I guess it was 6 o'clock then. And I forgot about it. And I remembered it at the last minute. And I got running down the railroad tracks towards the Ford shop. And I met my dad halfway there. And he was struggling where he'd got a big rope lugged around the battery, and he was trying to sling it on his shoulder. He wasn't happy with me. I know that. Anyway, made me remember one thing I should tell you about that you would never know about it today, but all over in Bristol, the one source of absolute time of